In this episode, a peek into the world of professional cycling, ketogenesis during workouts, phenylalanine and aspartic acid on ingredient labels, insomnia and nutrition deficiencies, compression socks, building leg muscles effectively, and the benefits of rowing machines.
Welcome to the Ben Greenfield Fitness.com podcast. We provide you with free exercise, nutrition, weight loss, triathlon, and wellness advice from the top fitness experts in the nation. So whether you're an Ironman triathlete or you're just trying to shed a few pounds, get ready for non-run-of-the-mill, cutting-edge content from BenGreenfieldFitness.com.
Hello, folks. I am traveling once again, and this week I'm at Interbike in Las Vegas on Wednesday, the day this podcast comes out, and Thursday as well as Friday. And for those of you who don't know what Interbike is, it's really one of the world's biggest bike expos where endurance athletes, cyclists, triathletes, and anyone in any of those industries comes together and basically shows what's coming in the industry over the next year in terms of gear, nutrition, and new products. It'll be an exciting show, and I'll be releasing videos from that show over at a website for which I do some journalism work at everymantry.com. So go to everymantry.com to see some of the latest and greatest cycling type of products. And I'll also be doing some reviews of some of the health and fitness products that I see there right here at bengreenfieldfitness.com. Now, I'll be headed down to Sacramento on Friday to teach a fat loss and human performance seminar. So if you're in the Sacramento or El Dorado Hills area, just email ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com and I'll fill you in on where to go and how to access that seminar. And then finally, I'll be headed down to San Francisco on Monday for a top secret meeting down there that I'll bring you more information about later on. Now, the only thing I wanted to announce before we get on to the special announcements is that I know that many of you have enjoyed the articles that I write for Triathlete Magazine. And I've also been doing writing for several other publications and many websites. However, I received a memo from Triathlete Magazine last week that freelance writers who submit articles to that magazine are no longer allowed to actually write for any other publications. So, unfortunately, I'm going to have to move on to Triathlete Magazine because I simply cannot commit to only releasing articles for one single magazine. For any of you writers out there, you know that that would be career suicide, and when somebody like me, who relies on writing as part of the way that I pay the bills, is required to only write for one magazine, that's a pretty tough rule to follow. So I won't be writing for Triathlete Magazine anymore. My apologies to those of you who enjoyed seeing my articles there. And if that's something that upsets you or it's something that you don't like, then write an email to the email address that I'll put in the show notes for the editor of Triathlete Magazine. So if you go to the show notes for podcast number 113, I'll put the email right there and you can let Triathlete Magazine know what you think about me not writing for them anymore. So, ending on that high note, let's go ahead and move on to this week's special announcements.
Special announcements.
First of all, we've had a lot of people accessing the full written transcripts of every show. If you have shows that you'd like to share with family and friends, and maybe they're not into listening to things on an MP3 player, or they just don't understand podcasts and the concept of podcasting, then send them a link to the transcripts if you have something you want to share with them. Say that you want to send them the interview on hypothyroidism that we did with Dr. Fit. Then you can simply go to the link that I'll put in the show notes to this episode, episode number 113. You'll have access to a downloadable free PDF of any of the transcribed show notes, and you can do a search in those if you want for specific keywords, etc. And on the top of each PDF is a list of everything that we went over in the show. The next thing is that for you triathletes out there, the Rockstar Triathlete Academy, which is the online training school that I run for triathletes, is constantly growing. New videos and audios added nearly every day, but that's only open at the current member rate of $37 until October 1st. Anybody that's a member now or anybody that joins before October 1st will stay at that $37 rate, but tuition will increase to $67 on October 1st. So if you've been thinking about the Rockstar Triathlete Academy, now is the time to get in. Now, in addition to that, the relaunch of the Triathlon Dominator package at triathlondominator.com is going to take place during Ironman week. Many of you know that I'm racing the Ironman Hawaii World Championships, and during the entire week that I am down in Kona preparing for that race, I'm adding a handful of bonuses to the Triathlon Dominator package. Too many bonuses to even mention in this podcast. It would take me a while. But what you can do is go to triathlondominator.com or go to the show notes for this podcast, and you can get all the information about that Triathlon Dominator release. Current Dominators will get full access to all those bonuses, as will anyone who becomes a Dominator between now and October 9th at midnight. And then the last special announcement is that for the Austin, Texas triathlon training camp that I'm putting on, for any of you who were kind of on the fence about signing up, I am now offering full refunds if you want to sign up and then make up your mind later on, but you just want to claim your spot. So go to the link to the Austin, Texas all-inclusive triathlon training camp that I'll put in the show notes to this podcast, number 113, and you'll be able to sign up for that with no actual commitment. So let's go ahead and move on to this week's show, which is going to include an interview with a guy who knows a lot about professional cycling, Robbie Ventura. But before we get to that, we're going to start with this week's listener Q&A.
Get the inside edge from Ben Greenfield Fitness delivered straight to your phone. Just text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll instantly get exclusive VIP discounts and insider tips that no one else will ever see except you. Do it now. Text the word fitness to 411247 and you'll be in Ben's VIP text club for free.
Listener Q&A.
Remember, if you have a question for the Ben Greenfield Fitness podcast, you can email ben@bengreenfieldfitness.com. You can call toll-free to 877-209-9439. We had a lot of call-in questions this week. Or you can Skype, if you're international, to username PacificFit using the free voiceover IP call service from Skype.com. And the first question this week comes from Ian, who asks, why sometimes after a training session do I have an ammonia-like smell in my nostrils by the time I get to the shower? Is it something I'm not doing right with nutrition? I can't figure it out. Well, this is something that actually happens to more people than you'd think. And it's basically almost like an acidic ammonia-like smell that you get in your nostrils. And you can sometimes taste it a little bit in your mouth or even smell almost like a nail polish removal on your breath when this is happening to you. Now, basically, this comes down to the concept of ketones. So I'm going to explain this to you. Ketones are basically a normal fuel that the body uses for energy, and they're produced from the liver actually breaking down body fat or breaking down fatty acids when it doesn't have access to a lot of carbohydrates or glucose. Now, there's absolutely no rule that you have to break down carbohydrate or glucose to make energy. The body very efficiently breaks down fats and fatty acids to make energy, and these ketones are a byproduct of that breakdown of fatty acid. Now, when your body is producing these ketones or using ketones for fuel, it's called ketosis. Any diet that restricts calories underneath what you're actually using during the day from exercise and physical activity, or any diet that severely restricts carbohydrates, is going to put you into a state of ketosis, because basically your body is going to start relying on fat for fuel. And so the liver is going to convert these fats into energy and ketones. Now, some people in the medical profession will tell you that burning these ketones for energy can be dangerous, or that high levels of ketones in the body can be dangerous. But the main reason for that is because there's a condition that diabetics can get called ketoacidosis. It's very dangerous for diabetics because what happens is the blood pH becomes very acidic, due to high blood sugar levels. And that's because diabetics don't produce insulin, so lots of blood sugar ends up being in the body. And ketones are produced by the body to provide fuel, since the cells aren't able in the diabetic who's in a state of ketoacidosis to be able to use the blood sugar. So you get this combination of high blood sugar and an acidic condition combined with high levels of ketones. Now, the high levels of ketones aren't the bad thing. The very acidic pH is the bad thing. The high blood sugar and the high levels of sugar circulating in the bloodstream, that's the problem, not the ketones. So ketones really are fine to burn. Producing energy from fatty acids is something that more of us could do more of the time. The brain actually really likes to use ketones for energy. That's why some people who do intermittent fasting or people who go on severe caloric restriction or go on a diet for a certain period of time, they get very focused mentally because the brain learns how to very efficiently use those ketones, its natural source of fuel, for energy. Now, on the flip side, if you are training for performance, if you are not trying to lose weight, and if you are struggling with energy levels, then being in a state of ketosis may not be where you want to be, especially during your workout. And that's why for a lot of folks, I really do encourage a higher fat, higher protein diet. But before that workout, you should be attempting to, if you're going after performance or doing a hard workout, to get a pre-workout meal consisting of carbohydrates so that you're not burning so many ketones for energy during your workout. Now, there's a very easy way to tell if you're in a state of ketosis. You can just get pH strips that are urine pH strips. And when you use those pH strips, if they're showing up purple or dark purple, that's usually indicating that there are actual ketones that are at a high level in the bloodstream. And I'm again, not saying that that's a bad thing, but that would affirm what I'm suspecting here, that ammonia-like smell on your breath is due to the burning of ketones. If you feel great, if your energy levels are fine, if you're not having performance deficits, then take a breath mint and get on with your life. But if you are having low energy levels, if your performance isn't where you need it to be, then consider amping up your carbohydrate levels a little bit, especially pre-workout or even during the workout, so that you can burn some of the fast-burning kindling for fuel, the carbohydrates, and then, you know, put that slow-burning log on the fire, those ketones, and basically use those fatty acids as energy the rest of the time. So I hope that helps. It's a great question. A lot of people actually struggle with that, and I've smelled it on clients before as a personal trainer, and sometimes it's a real hint as to what's going on in the diet. Listener Sarah says, I am taking a lot of supplements for performance and other health benefits. I'm taking an amino acid supplement that contains aspartic acid and phenylalanine. I've seen foods that contain phenylalanine and have a warning on their label for that purpose. I've also done research on both of these and see that they're part of the sugar substitute aspartame. Are these amino acids, or do these amino acids have health benefits, or should I stop taking this supplement because it isn't healthy? First of all, when you see a warning for phenylalanine on the label of a nutrition product, when it says it contains a source of phenylalanine or contains phenylalanine, that is because there is a portion of the population that are born with this rare genetic disorder. It's called phenylketonuria, and basically it's an inability to properly metabolize phenylalanine. And this can lead to some health problems that we don't need to get into, but basically lots of foods contain phenylalanine, both packaged foods as well as meat, fish, dairy, eggs, and of course anything that has aspartame in it. And so these people who are phenylketonurics, they have to be very careful with their phenylalanine intake because they can only process so much of it. You will know if you have this condition. You will have known since birth, or your parents will have known most likely. And so unless you have this condition, the phenylalanine is really not something that you have to worry about too much. It's actually an essential amino acid, meaning that your body can't make it. It's a building block for protein. It's not a dangerous chemical. Because it is able to be combined with some other chemicals to produce a sweet taste, it is, however, used in NutraSweet and products with aspartame. So that's where you have to be kind of careful, is if you're getting phenylalanine from a product just because it has an essential amino acid in it, that's not a big deal. If you're getting phenylalanine in a product because you're consuming an artificial sweetener, that's something that you do need to be careful with, especially when you consider that many artificial sweeteners contain what are called excitotoxins. And aspartic acid, which you also mentioned, is among those excitotoxins. And what an excitotoxin is it's a chemical that can actually damage nerve cells. And essentially what it does is an excitotoxin will bind to certain receptors in your brain and cause a lot of calcium ions or calcium to be able to enter into the brain. And that can activate a lot of different enzymes that potentially can destroy cell structures and components of your cell membrane. They can mess up the DNA a little bit. They can mess up the cytoskeleton of the cell a little bit. And excitotoxins have been associated with some neurodegenerative diseases like multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, alcoholism, things of that nature. And the thing with aspartic acid is also an amino acid, but it's not an essential amino acid. And so consuming foods that are very, very high in aspartic acid could be an issue. It kind of depends. Technically, from a chemical standpoint, it really needs to be what's called the base of aspartic acid, which is also known as aspartate. So if you see aspartate on the label, which you'll see in something like aspartame or some other artificial sweeteners, that's where you want to be careful. Aspartic acid is part of like an essential amino acid, or I'm sorry, not an essential amino acid, but just an amino acid compound or a protein powder is not a big deal. Just be careful with aspartate and don't worry too much about the phenylalanine. So good question. And we're going to move on next to a call-in question.
Hi, Ben. I have a question for you concerning my teenage daughter. She's had a problem that's been getting worse with falling asleep. But more importantly, when she does get to sleep, she wakes up around 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and can't get back to sleep, and that seems to be the worst problem. She's a vegetarian, so I'm wondering if she might be missing something in her diet. Just wondered if you had any ideas as to what food or supplement she might want to look at to help her sleep better. Again, my name is Jeffrey Chandler, and it's Geoffrey. And my phone is 317-590-3291, and my email address is jeffreydean33@gmail.com. That's Jeffrey, Geoffrey, Dean, Dean, 33@gmail.com. Thank you very much. Enjoy your show. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, first of all, nothing I say here is to be misconstrued as medical advice to control a medical condition or medical diagnosis or prescription. However, there are definitely nutritional deficiencies that could be contributing to insomnia, especially in a vegetarian diet. I'm not necessarily saying that vegetarianism is the culprit here, but it could be likely. You take, for example, the B vitamins. B vitamins really help your body cope with stress, with tension, and both of those are common causes of insomnia. Vitamin B12 specifically is something that vegetarians need to really be careful to supplement with or get in high amounts in their diets. You find vitamin B in things like brewer's yeast and nuts and seeds, molasses and eggs. Whole grains have them, but vegetarians are notoriously deficient in B vitamins. Tryptophan is an amino acid, and amino acids are always found in higher contents in meats and dairy products, and to a limited extent in nuts. But tryptophan is a substance in the body that is converted into serotonin, which is a compound that's crucial for sleep. And so if she's low in the amino acid tryptophan, which you could get that tested by a company like for example, Bioletics does amino acid testing. That's one company that you could ask about looking into her tryptophan levels. That's something that could be a culprit as well. Vegetarians are notorious carnivores, and a high sugar diet because of high blood sugar levels can basically cause you to wake up at night once those blood sugar levels drop off, because essentially you get an insulin response to the hyperglycemia, and then your blood sugar levels drop off and you wake up in the middle of the night. So if your daughter has erratic blood sugar levels because she's eating lots of grains and sugars and processed carbohydrates because she is a vegetarian, is either not managing her protein intake well or just avoiding meat and eggs in favor of carbohydrates, then that could be an issue. And the trick there is going to be to really increase the vegetarian-based fats and proteins if she wants to remain a vegetarian. So getting lots of avocados and olive oils and olives and lots of seeds and nuts and seed and nut-based oils that are cold-pressed and not produced in a factory or exposed to high amounts of pressure or temperature. So we're talking about like a cold pressed olive oil or a flaxseed oil or one of the Udo's oils that I actually take now, the Udo 369 oil. I shared last week that when I'm consuming these fats with my meals, it actually really stabilizes my blood sugar levels. You would expect them to increase after a meal, but those fats in fact decrease my blood sugar following a meal. Those would all be things to consider. Selenium is another compound that could actually be tied to insomnia. People with low levels of selenium often have higher levels of high blood pressure, which can contribute to insomnia. And so that's something that I'd look into as well. And along with selenium, I would look into the mineral magnesium. And Carolyn Dean, Dr. Carolyn Dean, is someone who I interviewed on the show. I would highly recommend that you go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com and you do a search for the magnesium miracle. And in this interview with Carolyn Dean, she talks quite a bit about the link between magnesium and insomnia. And you could, for example, just try something like using a Peter Gillum's natural calm powder mixed into a little bit of water before bed at night, or a topical magnesium spray. And then if you really want to get down and dirty and get into the testing, you could use, for example, you could use a company like Unikey Health Systems. That's one of the companies that I recommend to my clients for tissue mineral analysis, but also food allergy and food intolerance testing. I use their expanded GI panel and their tissue mineral analysis. So I'll put a link to Unikey Health Systems in the show notes. I'd also look into Bioletics. You could look into the magnesium testing with them as well as the amino acid testing from them. And finally, I'll put a link to the two magnesium products that I would recommend in terms of like a pre-bed intake. I'll put all that as a link in the show notes. All right, the next question is from an interesting Twitter handle, Chunky Bear Cub. And Chunky Bear Cub asks via Twitter, "Is there a particular brand of compression socks you recommend? I'm looking to wear a pair for a 50-mile ultra." Well, for those of you who aren't familiar with compression socks or what they are, you'll see a lot of people wearing them in marathons, cycling events, and triathlons these days. They're usually socks that go up just a little bit above the calf or even all the way up to the knee. And essentially, they're designed to improve circulation, prevent blood pooling in the feet during long periods of time spent in physical activity, and to also stabilize the muscles from jiggling, so to speak, from some of the damage that could occur during a long day of impact. Now, the type of compression socks used in sports are quite different than some of the medical hosiery that you'll see used as compression socks. A lot of the medical stuff is just designed to eliminate some of the excessive swelling that can happen during long periods of sitting or inactivity. And those can help you a little bit if you're just sitting on an airplane or something like that. But the type of socks that are actually designed for sports performance are called graduated or gradient compression socks. And those are the type that you want to get. And most of the top manufacturers, Skins is one example, Beaker Concepts is another, they're going to use the graduated compression socks. Now, I personally own a pair of compression tights, and I wear those typically the night before I do a race to really help flush my legs. Sometimes I'll even use them a few days leading up to a triathlon. And although I don't or have not yet used compression socks during a race, I will be using kind of like a modified shorter version of the Beaker Concepts compression sock prior to or during Ironman Hawaii this year. And I'm also using a sock called the Recovery Sock that is a little bit higher in the compression type of fibers, but a little bit harder to put on. And that's not designed for activity per se, but for recovery. Now, as far as a certain brand, it doesn't really matter too much on the brand as much as the fact that you're getting a sock that was designed for activity, not recovery, and also make sure that it's a graduated compression sock. And that'll help out quite a bit. And yes, there has been research done on compression socks. Research goes back and forth in terms of performance benefits, but definitely points to a significant benefit when it comes to recovery. And in my opinion, while you are running something like an ultra marathon, recovery is paramount, because when you're running miles 25 through 50, you are trying to recover from miles 1 through 25. And so that's the same reason that you would want to do something like take in a protein carbohydrate blend rather than just carbohydrate during an event like that, just because you need to be thinking about recovery during the event, not just after the event. Now, if you want to ask a question via Twitter, just go to twitter.com/BenGreenfield, click follow, and ask your question. So next we have a call-in question from listener Sarah.
Hi, Ben. My question is geared towards muscle building. I have two questions, one of which is for someone who is wanting to put a good amount of muscle on and who is specifically in the legs, how much cardio would you recommend? I'm trying to put on a good amount of muscle. I get mixed reviews about the cardio because I'm a woman, and I've talked to a couple of figure competitors that have said that on non-training days it's okay to do upwards to 45 minutes to an hour worth of cardio. I don't know if that's too much cardio, especially if you have a tendency to tear down a lot of muscle in the legs. I've heard also that just 20 minutes of interval training is sufficient enough. I'm currently doing 3 to 4 sessions of cardio a week. On the days that I train, sometimes I'll do 30 minutes and that's it. On the days that I don't train, I have taken their advice and a couple times done upwards to 45 minutes. But I don't want to tear down muscle since I'm trying to build it, so I was curious on what your recommendations would be. My second question is about carbs. I'm doing the recommendations that Darren said. He was in your podcast several months ago about eating carbs on the days that you train and very little carbs on the days that you don't train. But I train at night. So my third and fourth meal are carbs, but my last meal would be my post-workout meal. And by that time I come home, I'm tired from lifting heavy. I do take my protein in, of course, a good amount of protein. I don't take in a lot of carbs for my post because I go right to bed. What are your recommendations on how much carbs I should take post-workout, and that would be my last workout, and it would be prior for bed?
All right, so let's first address the first part of your question. For a female figure competitor who's trying to build muscle, the first thing that you want to consider when it comes to cardio is that you don't want to do exercises that are considered very catabolic, or exercises that are more prone to tear down your leg musculature. And in this case, that would be running. I would stay away from doing much treadmill, high-impact running. And instead, I would do incline walking or cycling. Either of those activities will allow you to maintain your leg musculature, even build leg musculature, especially in the hips, thighs, and butt, where female figure competitors can actually get an advantage, and not break down your muscle. Now, in terms of general figures, you're going to see most figure competitors kind of in the off season prior to those final 4 to 8 weeks building up to a figure event, doing anywhere in the range of about 3 to 6 hours of cardio during the week in addition to their lifting. And as you get closer and closer to the event, you're looking at needing closer to 4 to 8 hours of cardio. And remember, I'm not recommending this for the general population. I'm recommending this for the female figure competitor who needs to achieve a very low body fat. Now, you're going to want to split this up between cardio intervals and long, slow, fat-burning cardio sessions, because you don't want to train your body to simply rely on those high-intensity intervals and the carbohydrate-based fuel, but you also want to include a few kind of slow, steady, fat-burning sessions as well. If time permits, you could do, for example, 2 interval sessions on the bike during the week, and then also do 2 long, slow, uphill walks on the treadmill, you know, of anywhere from 1 to 2 hours as well during the week. And again, we're talking about a female figure competitor. I'm not making this general recommendation for the general population, but that's what I would do, is go with non-weight-bearing cardio, focus on lower amounts, you know, right around that four-hour range as you're not within 8 weeks of your competition, then bump that up to 4 to 8 hours as you get within range of your competition, and you don't have to worry about breaking down muscle as long as you're eating proper calories and protein. And speaking of calories, the second part of your question, as far as your post-workout carbohydrate intake, what happens is when you consume pre-workout carbohydrates, a lot of times your insulin levels and your blood sugar levels are still going up or stabilizing even after you're done with the workout, unless you're doing some monster 2 to 3 hour workout. And so the need for post-workout carbohydrate and even post-workout protein intake really is not something that you need to prioritize too much. I recently wrote an article about this over at the Rockstar Triathlete Academy. If you go to rockstartriathlete.com, you can read that article on post-workout nutrition. But essentially what it comes down to is that if anybody, not just a female figure competitor, but anybody is working out late at night and you've eaten a carbohydrate and protein-based meal prior to that workout, there's no need to do anything but have a very small snack after that workout before you go to bed. And the advantage to that is that you're not raising your insulin levels very high. You're not going to get that hypoglycemic drop, which can interfere with sleep and also interfere with growth hormone release and muscle repair. And so you're really doing yourself a favor by prioritizing your pre-workout nutrition if you're a late-night exerciser. And then after the workout, you could do something, for example, like have a little bit of protein powder mixed in with some coconut milk and go to bed. So the post-workout carbohydrate is not something you need to worry about too much if you're taking in a pre-workout meal. If you've skipped your pre-workout meal, then at that point, the body is basically going to be bulletproof against fat gain after the workout. If you haven't eaten your pre-workout meal and you're actually a little bit glycogen depleted, so you don't have to worry too much about the type of carbohydrate or overdoing it on the carbohydrates within reason. The general recommendation, though, is about 0.5 grams of carbohydrate per pound of body weight, okay, 0.5 grams per pound. So if you're 150 pounds, you'd be looking at right around 75 grams of carbohydrate, which is going to be about 300 calories or so. So hope that helps, and great questions. And then finally, we have one more call-in question.
Hi, Ben. Love your podcast. My name is Daniel Nudelman. I'm from Israel. I'd like to ask you a question for the next podcast about the difference between rowing, running, and swimming in intensity, calorie burning, and interval training. Is there a benefit for rowing instead of running, or rowing instead of swimming? And if you row is not run, can you achieve the same goals of body image and condition? Thanks a lot. Bye.
So the deal with rowing machines, Daniel, is that when you compare them to swimming, you actually end up burning more calories with the rowing machine if you're using it properly. And what I mean by that is that if you're pulling with your thighs, your stomach, your hips, your torso, your calves, and your arms as you're supposed to on a rowing machine and making it a full body motion, you're going to end up getting just about as many calories burnt as if you were running at a pretty intense pace on a treadmill. You will see a lot of people sit down on a rowing machine at the gym and just kind of do some ginger pulling with their arms, or push with their legs and not do much pulling with their arms. Those people really aren't using a rowing machine effectively. But when used effectively, you get a ton of benefits, especially in your upper arms, your upper back, and your shoulders, and also in your glutes from that push off with the rowing machine. Now, I'm not a huge fan of doing long bouts of training on the rowing machine. I've actually had that damage the low back of some of my clients before when they're trying anywhere from a 20 to a 45-minute bout on the rowing machine. So what we go for instead is to use the rowing machine as an interval, as part of a workout. So for example, if you're doing an upper body workout or even just a full body weightlifting type of workout, after you finish each circuit of exercises that you're doing, you know, let's say you're doing 5 or 6 exercises, you pause, you go over to the rowing machine, you row hard for 500 meters or for 1,000 meters or for 2 minutes or for 4 minutes, and then you get off and continue your routine, and that gives you a great cardio burst in the middle of your routine. rowing machines because of the type of muscles that they use in a similar way as a swimmer, you will notice that you'll gain just a little bit of mass, especially in your chest and your forearms and your shoulders when you use a rowing machine. So it can be good for those aesthetic purposes as well. I personally will hop on a rowing machine about once a week just because it is something my body isn't used to, because I'm not doing it as much as I'm doing, say, swimming or bicycling or running. So it's a great way for me to burn a lot of calories very quickly because I'm not an efficient rower. And because I don't do rowing very much, I'm not very efficient at it. It's something that I make it a point to throw in just to help out a little bit with my calorie burning and my conditioning. So make sure that you row with proper form. If you do, you're going to burn more calories than swimming, as many as running, and it's also going to be really beneficial for strength building and physical appearance. So great question. And we are going to have a special message and then move on to this week's interview with Robbie Ventura.
Did you know you can get personalized nutrition and fitness consulting from Ben Greenfield no matter who you are? If you want to run a triathlon, lose a few pounds, reinvent your diet, or have Ben create a training program or nutrition plan that's customized to you, here's what you need to do. Visit tinyurl.com/help from Ben. That's tinyurl.com/help from Ben. Ben will personally contact you within 48 hours. What are you waiting for? Visit tinyurl.com/help from Ben today and get the body and results you've always wanted. Featured topic.
Hey folks, this is Ben Greenfield, and I'm here today with a guy who was a professional cyclist for 12 years and actually spent his last 4 years as a member of the U.S. Postal Service cycling team, which you may recall was the same team that Lance Armstrong rode with. And this guy was a competitive racer when he was riding on the dirt, road, and track since the age of 7 years old. And over that time, he had over 70 victories during his professional career. He was a member of the U.S. World Team. He rode the track world championships. And he is now a cycling coach, serves as director of CycleOps training. He owns Vision Quest Training, and he also is somebody that you may recognize from TV because he's now with Versus Television and is a commentator on all of the Tour de France coverage for Versus. Robbie Ventura is on the call today, and Robbie, how you doing?
Doing great. Doing super. We got a great day here in Chicago, and driving my buddy to the airport and want to talk training.
Awesome. Well, Robbie knows a lot about training. So, Robbie, I guess my first question for you is, you've done a lot of professional cycling. We have a lot of cyclists and triathletes who listen to the show, and I'm personally curious as well, what exactly does a typical training protocol look like in those build weeks, in the kind of the crunch time leading up to something like the Tour de France? What type of workouts are you guys doing?
So for the Tour de France athletes, it's significantly different than the recreational athlete. Even the very, very serious recreational athletes. I mean, I consider myself a pretty serious recreational athlete. Now I train between, 8 and 12 hours a week, which is a lot of training time. We even have athletes that train up to 15 hours. And it's nowhere near the amount of volume that the Tour de France athletes train. And the reason why they can absorb that volume is because, really, it's all they do. They eat, sleep, and recover pretty much the rest of the day, so they can handle, training 5 or 6 hours a day, day after day. Whereas even if we had the time as recreational athletes, since we have families and kids and jobs and yard work and other things to do, we just can't afford ourselves the recovery necessary to be able to handle those loads. So leading up to the Tour de France, a lot of times these riders will do between 25 and 30 hours, maybe about a month out. And the neat thing about the preparation for the Tour de France is a lot of times they do it on the exact courses they're going to race, because just like, anyone else who trains for an Ironman or trains for a Criterium or trains for a 40K time trial, being as specific as they can be is really important those last 2 months before the Tour de France, so much so that they even race the Dauphiné Libre a lot of times, which is similar roads, similar courses, similar climbs to the Tour de France to kind of give them that kind of last minute sharpening of the blade, so to say. Oftentimes, the first week of the Tour de France kind of creates that last 2 weeks of training. If the first week of the Tour de France is easy and these riders can recover, they're going to want to train all the way up to the Tour de France with very, very little recovery week, because they use that first week of the Tour to recover, because they can, and this is the GT riders. The sprinters will take a different approach because they're sprinting in that first week of the Tour de France, so they're going to take a rest week and a little bit of a taper the week before. So this year's Tour de France was different. They raced hard from the gun. Therefore, the riders rested significantly more than they usually do leading to the Tour.
Gotcha. Now, what would a workout look like an average workout? Can you give me an idea in terms of like an interval training session or something like that, what a cyclist would be doing?
For the Tour de France, it's not what you think. They don't do a lot of intervals per se leading up to the Tour de France. They actually go ride the climbs pretty much at race pace. And that's kind of their interval. Sometimes that climb may be 30 minutes. Sometimes that climb may be an hour. But they try to ride that climb at the same pace or the same watts per kilo that they would in the race. And sometimes they finish it off with an attack or something like that, kind of predicting what the race might shake out. A lot of the interval training is actually done significantly earlier in the year when they're really focusing on those individual energy systems, like their VO2, kind of that short-term energy system, or some of the longer steady-state stuff. But a lot of the professional athletes allow the terrain to create their intervals. So they'll go out and say, hey, I'm going to go climb up Left Hand Canyon four times today. Not so much worried about the exact time of the interval, but they really want to simulate kind of the energy system that they're focusing on. Because when you train as much as these guys do, doing a 2 minute interval on, 3 minutes off, and doing that kind of stuff, they do far less of that than, let's just say, a recreational athlete with limited time. Because when you have limited time, you want to really make sure the workouts are concise and measurable and repeatable. Therefore, the interval work for a 90-minute training session is much more specific than these guys going out for 6 hours and getting, let's just say, 10, 1 to 2 minute efforts in throughout the 6 hours.
That makes sense. Now, you had mentioned recovery, and we'll talk about recovery a little bit later for those of you who want to know how these guys recover from a workout like that. But before we do, I've got a couple of questions for you. In terms of strength training or resistance training, whatever you want to call it, or something like, say, plyometrics, do you, in your experience, see a lot of professional cyclists using something like that?
A lot of cyclists use weight training as almost a break mentally and to keep themselves just strong and resistant to injury. They don't necessarily build a lot of strength because that's going to make them faster in a road race or in a time trial. A lot of times the strength training that they do is really to get their heart rates up. They do some stuff where it's a lot of quick efforts extended over a minute. So it's a great way to kind of keep their heart rate up and to keep their intensity up without using their bicycle. And also, they really want to create a lot of durability. So they do a lot of functional movement. They do single-legged squats. They do sometimes some plyo work to get some explosiveness. The track sprinters and the short-distance riders tend to lift a little bit more weight, thinking that might help. But they've done a lot of research on actual pure strength and how it affects athletes' ability to produce power, steady-state power. And there's not a lot of correlation between people who can lift more weight and do more power in a time trial. Mm-hmm. There's a slight correlation with explosive, like a sprinter, like a track sprinter or a kilo rider, being able to lift a lot more weight might give them a little bit of an advantage on the high-end efforts, and their ability to tolerate more blood lactate, their ability to tolerate more high-intensity and muscle damage. But for a time trialer or a Tour de France rider, there's not a huge correlation with being stronger and being faster on the bike. But there is a correlation between athletes who are functionally fit, well-balanced, strong, and being able to not get injured as often. So I think a lot of the athletes do it, A, as a break mentally and to get some high work in and to become stronger. But they also do it because they really want to do everything they can to eliminate lower back problems, knee injuries, hip injuries, and things like that that sometimes plague cyclists and triathletes for that matter.
Did you do much weight training when you were riding professionally?
As a youngster, I did a lot of it because I didn't know any better, and I did a lot of squats, and I did a lot of plyometrics work. I even did some speed skating stuff, and I actually believed it helped my sprint a little bit, and I also believed it made me really strong and really powerful. I didn't get injured much at all in my cycling career, and I attributed to a lot of the weight work I did when I was 17 to 25 years of age. But after the age of about 25, I switched completely from single-legged squats, using a weight vest, doing some lunges, doing lateral lunges, doing some balance work on the ball, doing a lot more core stability work. And my power, my explosive power, my sprints didn't go down at all. But I was able to train more volume on the bike in the wintertime with less damage to my muscles. So I ended up kind of morphing my strength training into more functional training later in my career, and I think it was a good move.
Interesting. So in terms of actual nutrition, to move on here and talk about something a little bit different, obviously during the tour, people are needing to restore their carbohydrate levels, restore their glycogen levels post-workout. Now, when you're looking at somebody who has gone through a typical day of the tour, what are you typically seeing in terms of how much fuel and the type of fuel consumed during a typical tour stage, and also after, in terms of both, you know, calories, carbohydrates, things of that nature? Are there any specific volumes that are pretty standard across the board?
Well, it's interesting, you know, and even when I'm talking about weight training, you know, the elite professional cyclist the amount of focus and specificity that it takes to be a cyclist, I'm not recommending that recreational athletes, people doing Ironman, people doing just, you know, training less than, you know, 15 hours a week. I do believe strength training plays a huge role in making them better athletes and creating, you know, maintaining that muscle mass that we lose as we get older. So I think that there's a place for weight training for cyclists and triathletes. When you think about cyclists and you think about triathletes, you know, 98% of them, some of the things that we're talking about don't apply, because, you know, these professional cyclists, the Tour de France riders, that's all they do, and they don't want to be necessarily great athletes. They want to be great cyclists. And I think that there's sometimes when people hear what the professionals do, they go out and they try to mimic that, or they hear that works for Levi Lifheimer, and it really doesn't work for a lot of people outside of Levi Lifheimer that normally just want to get fit or want to be better bikers. So As far as calorie consumption, a lot of the guys in the Tour de France, they don't focus so much how many carbohydrates versus how many protein, sugar, and fat, and all those different things. They really want to get the volumes in that they need, and they're just incredible processors of fuel. I mean, they can process a Payday or a Twix bar probably just as efficiently as they can process a Clif bar. And I know there's going to be nutrition people that argue that till the cows come home, but when we were professionals, and if you look at some of the new cut bags of the riders in the Tour de France, there's candy bars, there's Coke, there's little pastries, there's cream cheese pastries, there's little turkey sandwiches, there's all sorts of food, because when you're taking that much volume of food, and they're probably taking in 400 calories an hour on average from the start of the race, from the first hour of riding, their stages are between 5 and 7 hours, so they're taking in that, you know, between 300 and 400 calories an hour, because that's really all they can process when they're working as hard as they are. So they don't want to take in more than that because it's wasted energy. But, you know, it's the volume, it's the amount of calories that they're trying to consume is more important to them than the actual makeup of those calories, I believe. Especially kind of later in the day where they want sugar, they want some caffeine, they want something that tastes good that they really want to crave, because after 21 days of racing, you know, 6 to 7 hours a day, eating something that's really nutritious but doesn't taste that well, they're going to choose not to eat, and that's the worst thing that could happen. Mm-hmm. It's better for them to eat something, even though it's not absolutely ideal because it tastes good, than nothing at all because they just can't get down a power bar after 20 days of racing. So I think 400 calories is kind of that magic number these guys try to hit, and they're trying to do at least 2 bottles an hour, and if it's really, really hot, They sometimes go up to 6 bottles an hour.
Do you really see much of a focus on say, like, liquids versus solids, or is it just kind of whatever you can get your hands on?
Well, the higher the intensity, the more liquids they try to get their calories from. Mm-hmm. If the intensity is low, they'd much rather eat their calories because it's more satisfying, and they don't need the – they can give up a little bit of the energy that it takes to digest, let's just say, a Cliff Bar. Mm-hmm. But if the intensity is high, they don't want to waste the energy in digesting – something that's solid, and they'll choose liquid calories more oftentimes if the case is hard.
Gotcha. Now, obviously related to nutrition, and I really don't want to touch on the doping scandal because that's a horse that gets kicked to death, but in terms of just sports performance supplements in general, you know, everything from creatine to nitric oxide to alanine to all these things that are kind of generally recognized as safe when it comes to doping, at least, or illegal performance-enhancing supplements. Are there nutrition supplements that are real popular among cyclists that are also considered safe that you're familiar with?
You know, I think that getting enough vitamin D, getting enough vitamins and trace elements and minerals, I think is the big push for endurance athletes right now. You know, getting your branched chain aminos, getting enough glutamine when you're really working hard and tearing down muscle and things like that, I think is important. But to be honest, early in my career, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, what vitamins I needed, what supplements made the most sense, what worked for me, what made me feel better. And I would say, you know, later in my career, I ended up just taking a multivitamin, actually a liquid multivitamin called Isogenix. And that was pretty much all I took later in my career. And I really tried to keep things as simple as possible because part of it was just when you're starting to take too many supplements and you're trying something like, what's the popular one? Optigen that some of the cyclists are taking right now. You start to, it's just one more thing you have to do. And then you feel like, you know, you have to do that. It doesn't make a difference. You really don't know if it's your training or the supplement. So I actually pulled way back. Does stuff work? I'm sure there's a lot of things that might work for some people, not others. And if you have something that's legal and safe and it works well for you, whether it's a placebo effect or whether it works, I think it's good to try. You just can't rely or get too many of those things that you're taking because it just becomes difficult, especially if you're traveling or on the road or if you don't have it, you start to feel like you need it or different things like that. So later in my career, I really stripped myself of all supplements or ergogenic aids or anything like that. And to be honest, my life got a whole lot easier and I could focus more on my training and I was much more consistent.
Gotcha. Okay. In terms of recovery techniques, obviously in a multi-stage race like the Tour and also in the training leading up to the Tour, you know, you've already explained that the level of training is over and above what the average recreational exerciser or even the serious age grouper is going to do. But do you have recovery techniques that kind of go beyond the whole rest, ice, compression, elevation, or you know, the occasional ice bath that the average person is doing? In other words, are there fringe techniques that you find to be more useful for recovery?
Well, I think, you know, the things that you mentioned actually are the things that work the best. Truly things that work the best. I think the one thing that you didn't mention was when I really need to recover, I really make 100% focus on my sleep. I think people try to figure out, hey, I'm going to wear these compression stockings, and then I'm going to go, you know, I'm going to ground my mattress with some grounding techniques, and all those things are great, and I think they're helpers, but the number one key element in terms of success is good sleep. And that doesn't just mean sleeping a long time. It means getting good quality sleep, good REM, good deep sleep, uninterrupted sleep in a room that's cool and dark, and trying to create an environment we can really sleep well. That is the real, true, best way to recover is to allow yourself to sleep great. And sometimes when you're really fatigued, your muscles are really broken down, and it's really core, heart, sleeping well is the hardest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to train yourself. It's just like cycling. You got to become a student of good sleep. And I think if you can do that, whether you're doing the Tour de France, you're doing an Ironman, you're doing your first trip, it's a triathlon, being able to sleep well in different circumstances. Because when you travel to different races, you go to hotels, you have to have a routine at a hotel as well. When you don't have all the things that you have at your house that allow you to sleep well.
Mm-hmm.
I think sleep is number one. Obviously, compression is great. We use Normatec at Vision Quest all the time. Normatec is a big sponsor of Vision Quest coaching. And at all our facilities, we try to have some recovery boots, those compression boots that you saw me kind of demonstrating at the Tour de France.
Mm-hmm.
A big component of lots of hydration, a good recovery drink if you have it, or a good meal after a hard ride to start that repairing quickly. And then just, you know, trying to relax your brain a little bit, relax your mind, and focus on, you know, a massage. A lot of people hear that a massage is good, and it's like, okay, I did a really hard ride, I'm going to get my first massage. Massage is another thing that you have to get used to. It's another process that your body, if not prepared for it, might reject it a little bit, and you may actually have some damage from a deep massage if you're not careful. So, again, kind of learning what your body responds to well, working with a massage therapist, understanding what your body needs in terms of how deep you want your massage to be, and really kind of getting into a recovery routine, I think is probably your best bet, especially when the volumes and the intensities get way up there, you know, months before a big competition.
Yeah, and it's really interesting point because, you know, I personally coach many triathletes, and a lot of times I'll get an email the week before a race or a phone call a few days before a race asking some of these questions about, you know, how can I sleep better? Do you have any tips for me to get to sleep as I'm nervous? Do you have any tips on a good massage therapist I could work with? And these are things people need to be thinking about during the training to really get optimum results.
Absolutely. And I think the people wait too long. If they wait till they're cracked before they start working on their recovery. And a lot of times they're not cracked until, you know, a month before the competition, after they've had their biggest volume or their biggest, you know, week of training. And by that time, those habits need to have been made by then. It's almost a little bit too late. And by that time, you don't want to start experimenting, right? You want to almost say, okay, I learned this for next time. I'm going to try to sleep well, because that's always something I have to experiment. If I do get a massage, I'm going to get a really light one just to make sure that it works. And if I am going to muscle around with compression and stuff like that, I'm not going to go crazy. I'm going to start soft or start easy and gradually ramp up the pressure or ramp up the time and make sure what I'm doing is actually working and I'm not trying to capture everything at once.
Right. All right. Folks, by the way, if you have questions about the things that we've discussed so far in terms of nutrition, training, strength training, interval training, any of that, be sure to leave it as a comment on the post that will go along in the show notes to this interview with Robbie. Robbie, I have kind of a final question for you, maybe a fun question, but what I'm wondering is if you have some examples of extreme cycling workouts or just extreme feats of human performance during a training session or a race that you've observed in the time that you've spent among professional cyclists. We hear things like, you know, stories about swimmers going out and doing a 10 by 1,000 swimming set, or runners going out to a track and throwing down a, you know, a 25 by 800 workout. Do you have any examples of extreme workouts that you've observed in the time that you've spent in professional cycling?
Well, you know, I think what's amazing about some of the training that, I mean, and I never did the Tour de France. I've never put in the volumes that some of these guys do, but the thing I find interesting about professional cyclists and some of the things that they can handle is not necessarily one specific training day, but guys that you hear stories about Hank Cappy doing, you know, back to back to back to back, you know, 5,000 to 6,000 kilojoule days. And just to do one 5,000 kilojoule day is very, very difficult, but to do them day after day after day for 4 or 5 days in very, very hot conditions, because when you throw heat into a workout, it really kind of takes the workout up by 10 or 15% depending on how hot it actually is. And to do 5,000 and 6,000 kilojoules a day in the heat, I think is something that I have never been able to do, and that's always been a limiter of mine. I just, one big day, I need a couple of days to recover, whereas these guys like Hincapie and Leipheimer and Armstrong, they can do 5,000 and 6,000 KJ days one after the other. And I just can't believe they can recover and do those things. It's really amazing. And it's a testament to not only their ability to train, but how much they have trained. Because to be able to do that stuff, you just have to have years and years and years of aerobic base training and aerobic riding under your belt. And I get a kick out of athletes that, you know, that have a lot of time to train, and they try to do these huge volume days, and they can do one of them. Sometimes they can do two of them. But unless you have that base, no matter how talented you are, you're just not going to be able to actually grow from those types of workouts. And nothing in particular, but just the fascination of the amount of volume, the amount of work these guys can put in and actually grow from it rather than just break down and basically wither away like most athletes would do under those types of stresses.
Interesting. And it seems like a lot of the things that you've talked about today in terms of proper sleep, proper fueling during and after a workout, proper recovery protocols, as well as possibly a little bit of strength training or body balance training to allow for injury prevention, and then consistency. A lot of that is really what it takes to do these day after day hard training sessions, is the impression I'm getting from you.
It takes time. I think people that want to be good aerobic athletes, you can't rush the process. And that's the biggest mistake I find with our Vision Quest, some of our Ironman triathletes, even our Kona qualifiers and our high-level Ironman athletes, is it takes 4 or 5 years for your body really to become aerobically fit. And then it takes another 5 years after that to really maximize that. I mean, I rode my bicycle for 35 years. I'm going to turn 40 soon. I was right to that. Maybe closer to 30 years. And I felt like I grew my aerobic system for 20 some of those years. And I trained hard and I trained long. And it took that long before I felt like I was maxed out. So I think for aerobic athletes, they need to be patient. They need to be really patient. And they need to overtrain a little bit. And I think there's some benefit to overtraining to kind of understand where those limits are. And then realize when you've passed the overtraining mark, and then back it off. I think you have to overtrain a few times to understand where those limits are and to push those limits. But once you understand where they're at, you run up to them, and you just try to gradually push those out. You don't try to make a 20% volume increase in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. It's small increments over time that wins the race.
Right. Well, Robbie, this has been great advice. Where can people find out more about you and what you do?
VisionQuestCoaching.com. We have a great group of athletes that we work with. We have a bunch of facilities in the Chicagoland area. We also have one at David's World Cycle in Orlando, Florida. They do a great job down there. We have camps in Santa Rosa in the spring that are a lot of fun, where we actually try to mimic those high volumes that the pros do, and we take care of all of their needs, from their laundry to exactly everything. Just like a professional, and these athletes are surprised at how much volume they can withstand when we basically do all the work for them. So all they have to focus on is riding their bicycle, recovering through massage or massage therapy. And we have Max Testa. We have always have great guests that come to our camps as well and do talks. And it's really if you want to grow your aerobic engine, you want to become a better cyclist, you want to become a better triathlete, I can't emphasize enough how those camps or those blocks of training really make the big differences. I think it's better to kind of do a couple of camps or a few camps in the spring rather than try to, you know, train every third day long at your house where it's a struggle. Make it more out of a 5 or a 6 day big block where you don't have anything to focus on but recovery, or if you really want to develop aerobically, as well as, you know, basically submerging yourself in a culture where you're learning bike handling, you're learning pacing, you're learning power-based training, you're learning everything there is to know about run, bike, and swim. And you're basically getting this force fed into you for 6 days. You come out a different person, and you really reset your gauges in terms of aerobically, as well as your knowledge of cycling when you do stuff like that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm also a big fan of camps. If you can find one to go to, it's well worth it. So, Robbie,
our camps are great.
Oh, what's that?
I said our camps are great. We have We're actually doing one in Arizona. I'm doing it with Gordo Byrne. I'm not in Arizona, in Las Vegas with Gordo Byrne in October. And then our next camp is in the spring in Santa Rosa.
Cool.
So, check out our website, visionquestcoaching.com. We'd love to help anybody out that wants to be in aerobic training. And that's all.
All right. Well, Robbie, thanks for coming on the call today. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. And, hopefully everyone will train smart, have fun, and remember that it's the process that's the good stuff. It's not the result.
Awesome. That's good advice. All right. Have a good one.
Thanks, man. Ciao.
All right, folks, that's going to wrap up today's podcast. Remember to keep your eyes on everymantry.com for updates from me for Interbike, and also keep your eye on bengreenfieldfitness.com for some health and fitness videos and updates from that show, as well as some audio interviews. Now, remember a couple of the other special announcements about the Rockstar Triathlete Academy and getting into that before October 1st if you're interested in locking in the current Rockstar tuition, checking out the Triathlon Dominator bonuses that are coming out during Ironman Week, during Ironman Hawaii from October 4th through October 10th. Check out the Triathlon Training Camp and the new refund policy for that training camp. And then finally, if you want to say something to Triathlete Magazine about the fact that I'm no longer allowed to write for them, then you may want to email them using the email address that I've posted in the show notes to this podcast, podcast number 113. So until next time, this is Ben Greenfield from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have a healthy week.